shoulder and said, "It was really, really scary. I just saw the smoke and, like, I was really scared." The interviewer said, "What were your thoughts when you heard the explosion?" "I was really scared," the girl said. "Did you think it was a bomb?" she was asked. "Absolutely," she said. "A terrorist bomb." Kenny Burns spun on his heel, throwing his hands in the air. "Do you believe this shit? They're asking kids what they thought. This is the news. What did you think? Golly, I swallowed my popsicle." He snorted. "Airplanes that kill, and the travelers who love them." On the screen, the TV program now showed an elderly woman who said, "Yes, I thought I was going to die. Of course, you have to think that." Then a middle-aged man. "My wife and I prayed. Our whole family knelt down on the runway and thanked the Lord." "Were you frightened?" the interviewer asked. "We thought we were going to die," the man said. "The cabin was filled with smoke. It's a miracle we escaped with our lives." Byrne was yelling again, "You asshole! In a car you would have died, in a nightclub you would have died, but not in a Norton widebody. We designed it so you'd escape with your miserable fucking life." "Calm down," Casey said. "I want to hear this." She was listening intently, waiting to see how far they'd take the story. A strikingly beautiful Hispanic woman in a beige Armani suit stood facing the camera, holding up a microphone. While passengers now appear to be recovering from their ordeal, their fate was far from certain earlier this afternoon, when a Norton widebody blew up on the runway, orange flames shooting high into the sky. The TV again showed the earlier telephoto shot of the plane on the runway, with smoke billowing from under the wing. It looked about as dangerous as a doused campfire. "Wait a minute, wait a minute," Kenny said. "A Norton widebody exploded? A Sunstar piece of shit engine exploded." He pointed to the screen image. "That's a goddamn rotor burst, and the blade fragments broke through the cowling, which is just what I told them would happen." Casey said, "You told them?" "Hell yes," Kenny said. "I know all about this. Sunstar bought 6 engines from AeroCivicus last year. I was the Norton consultant on the deal. I boroscoped the engines and found a shitload of damage, blade notch breakouts and vane cracks, so I told Sunstar to reject them." Kenny was waving his hands. "But why pass up a bargain?" he said. "Sunstar rebuilt them instead. During teardown, we found a lot of corrosion, so the paper on the overseas overhauls was probably faked. I told them again, junk 'em. But Sunstar put them on the planes. So now the rotor blows, big fucking surprise, and the fragments cut into the wing, so that non-flammable hydraulic fluid is smoking. It ain't on fire because the fluid won't burn. And it's our fault?" He spun, pointing back to the screen. "Seriously frightening all 270 passengers on board. Fortunately, there were no injuries." "That's right," Byrne said. "No penetration of the fuse, lady. No injury to anybody. The wing absorbed it. Our wing. And we are waiting to speak to officials from the airline about this frightening tragedy. More later. Back to you, Ed." The camera cut back to the newsroom, where a sleek anchorman said, "Thank you, Alicia, for that up-to-the-minute report on the shocking explosion at Miami Airport. We'll have more details as they emerge. Now back to our regularly scheduled program." Casey sighed, relieved. "I can't believe this horse shit," Kenny Burns shouted. He turned and stomped out of the room, banging the door behind him. "What's his problem?" Richmond said. "For once, I'd say he's justified," Casey said. "The fact is, if there's an engine problem, it's not Norton's fault." "What do you mean? He said he was the consultant." "Look," Casey said, "you have to understand. We build airframes. We don't build engines, and we don't repair them. We have nothing to do with engines." "Nothing, I hardly think." "Our engines are supplied by other companies. GE, Pratt & Whitney, Rolls-Royce. But reporters never understand that distinction." Richmond looked skeptical. It seems like a fine point.
It's nothing of the sort. If your electricity goes out, do you call the gas company? If your tires blow, do you blame the car maker?
Of course not, Richmond said. But it's still your airplane, engines and all.
No, it's not, Casey said. We build the plane and then install the brand of engine the customer selects. Just the way you can put any one of several brands of tires on your car. But if Michelin makes a batch of bad tires and they blow out, that's not Ford's fault. If you let your tires go bald and get in an accident, that's not Ford's fault. And it's exactly the same with us.
Richmond was still looking unconvinced.
All we can do, Casey said, is certify that our planes fly safely with the engines we install. But we can't force carriers to maintain those engines properly over the life of the aircraft. That's not our job. And understanding that is fundamental to knowing what actually occurred. The fact is, the reporter got the story backward.
Backward? Why?
That aircraft had a rotor burst, Casey said. Fan blades broke off the rotor disc and the cowling around the engine didn't contain the fragments. The engine blew because it wasn't correctly maintained. It should never have happened. But our wing absorbed the flying fragments, protecting passengers in the cabin. So the real meaning of this event is that Norton aircraft are so well built that they protect 270 passengers from a bad engine. We're actually heroes. But Norton stock will fall tomorrow, and some of the public may be afraid to fly on a Norton aircraft. Is that an appropriate response to what actually happened? No. But it's an appropriate response to what's being reported. That's frustrating people here.
Well, Richmond said, at least they didn't mention Trans-Pacific.
Casey nodded. That had been her first concern, the reason she had rushed across the parking lot to the TV set. She wanted to know if the news reports would link the Miami rotor burst to the TPA in-flight incident the day before. That hadn't happened, at least not yet. But sooner or later, it would.
We'll start getting calls now, she said. The cat is out of the bag.
Hangar 5, 9:40 a.m. There were a dozen security guards standing outside Hangar 5, where the Trans-Pacific jet was being inspected. But this was standard procedure whenever an RAMS team from Recovery and Maintenance Services entered the plant. RAMS teams circled the globe, troubleshooting stranded aircraft. They were FAA licensed to repair them in the field. But since members were chosen for expertise rather than seniority, they were non-union, and there was often friction when they came into the factory. Within the hangar, the Trans-Pacific widebody stood in the glare of halogen lights, nearly hidden behind a gridwork of roll-up scaffolding. Technicians swarmed over every part of the plane. Casey saw Kenny Byrne working the engines, cursing his power plant crew. They had deployed the two thrust reverser sleeves that flared out from the nacelle and were doing fluorescent and conductivity tests on the curved metal cowls. Ron Smith and the electrical team were standing on a raised platform beneath the midship's belly. Higher up, she saw Van Trung through the cockpit window, his crew testing the avionics. And Doherty was out on the wing leading the structure team. His group had used a crane to remove an 8-foot aluminum section, one of the inboard slats.
Big bones, Casey said to Richmond.
They inspect the biggest components first.
It looks like they're tearing it apart, Richmond said.
A voice behind them.
It's called destroying the evidence.
Casey turned. Ted Rawley, one of the flight test pilots, sauntered up. He was wearing cowboy boots, a western shirt, dark sunglasses. Like most of the test pilots, Teddy cultivated an air of dangerous glamour.
This is our chief test pilot, Casey said. Teddy Rawley. They call him Rackham Rawley.
Hey, Teddy protested. I haven't drilled a hole yet. Anyway, it's better than Casey and the Seven Dwarfs.
Is that what they call her?
Richmond said, suddenly interested.
Yeah, Casey and her dwarves.
Rawley gestured vaguely to the engineers.
The little fellas. Hey-ho, hey-ho.
He turned away from the plane, punched Casey on the shoulder.
So, how you doing, kid? I called you the other day.
I know, she said. I've been busy.
I'll bet you have, Teddy said. I bet Martyr's got the screws on everybody. So, what have the engineers found?
Wait a minute, let me guess. They found absolutely nothing, right? Their beautiful plane is perfect. So, must be pilot error, am I right?
Casey said nothing. Richmond looked uncomfortable.
Hey, Teddy said, don't be shy. I've heard it all before. Let's face it, the engineers are all card-carrying members of the Screw the Pilots Club. That's why they design planes to be practically automatic. They just hate the idea that somebody might actually fly them. It's so untidy to have a warm body in the seats. Makes them crazy. And, of course, if anything bad happens, it must be the pilot. Gotta be the pilot. Am I right?
Come on, Teddy, she said. You know the statistics. The overwhelming majority of accidents are caused by... It was at that point that Doug Daugherty, crouched on the wing above them, leaned over and said dolefully,
Casey, bad news. You'll want to see this.
What is it?
I'm pretty sure I know what went wrong on Flight 545.
She climbed the scaffolding and walked out on the wing. Daugherty was crouched over the leading edge. The slats were now removed, exposing the innards of the wing structure. She got down on her hands and knees next to him and looked. The space for the slats was marked by a series of drive tracks, little rails spaced 3 feet apart that the slats slid out on, driven by hydraulic pistons. At the forward end of the rail was a rocker pin which allowed the slats to tilt downward. At the back of the compartment she saw the folding pistons which drove the slats along the tracks. With the slats removed, the pistons were just metal arms poking out into space. As always, whenever she saw the innards of an aircraft, she had a sense of enormous complexity.
What is it? She said.
Here, Doug said. He bent over one of the protruding arms, pointing to a tiny metal flange at the back, curved into a hook. The part was not much larger than her thumb.
Yes?
Daugherty reached down, pushed the flange back with his hand. It flicked forward again.
That's the locking pin for the slats, he said. It's spring-loaded, actuated by a solenoid back inside. When the slats retract, the pin snaps over, holds them in place.
Yes?
Look at it, he said, shaking his head. It's bent.
She frowned. If it was bent, she couldn't see it. It looked straight to her eye.
Doug?
No, look. He set a metal ruler against the pin, showing her that the metal was bent a few millimeters to the left.
And that's not all, he said. Look at the action surface of the hinge. It's been worn. See it?
He handed her a magnifying glass. 30 feet above the ground, she leaned over the leading edge and peered at the part. There was wear, all right. She saw a ragged surface on the locking hook. But you would expect a certain amount of wear where the metal of the latch engaged the slats.
Doug, do you really think this is significant?
Oh, yes, he said in a funereal tone. He got maybe 2-3 millimeters of wear here.
How many pins hold the slat?
Just one, he said.
And if this one is bad?
The slats could pop loose in flight. They wouldn't necessarily fully extend. They wouldn't have to. Remember, these are low-speed control surfaces. At cruise speed, the effect magnifies. A slight extension would change the aerodynamics.
Casey frowned, squinting at the little part through the magnifying glass. But why would the lock suddenly open 2/3 of the way through the flight?
He was shaking his head. Look at the other pins, Daugherty said, pointing down the wing. There's no wear on the action surface.
Maybe the others were changed out and this one wasn't?
No, he said. I think the others are original. This one was changed. Look at the next pin down. See the part stamp at the base?
She saw a tiny embossed figure, an H in a triangle with a sequence of numbers. All parts manufacturers stamped their parts with these symbols.
Yeah? Now look at this pin. See the difference? On this part, the triangle is upside down. This is a counterfeit part, Casey.
For aircraft manufacturers, counterfeiting was the single biggest problem they faced as they approached the 21st century. Media attention focused mostly on counterfeit consumer items like watches, CDs, and computer software. But there was a booming business in all sorts of manufactured items, including auto parts and airplane parts. Here, the problem of counterfeiting took a new and ominous turn. Unlike a phony Cartier watch, a phony airplane part could kill you.
Okay, she said. I'll check the maintenance records, find out where it came from.
The FAA required commercial carriers to keep extraordinarily detailed maintenance records. Every time a part was changed out, it was noted in a maintenance log. In addition, the manufacturers, though not required to, maintained an exhaustive ship's record of every part originally on the plane, and who had manufactured it. All this paperwork meant that every one of the aircraft's 1 million parts could be traced back to its origin. If a part was swapped out from one plane to another, that was known. If a part was taken off and repaired, that was known. Each part on a plane had a history of its own. Given enough time, they could find out exactly where this part had come from, who had installed it, and when. She pointed to the locking pin in the wing.
Have you photographed it?
Oh, sure, we're fully documented.
Then pull it, she said. I'll take it to Metals. By the way, could this situation give you a SLATS disagree warning?
Daugherty gave her a rare smile.
Yes, it could. And my guess is, it did. You got a non-standard part, Casey, and it failed the aircraft.
Coming off the wing, Richmond was chattering excitedly.
So, is that it? It's a bad part? Is that what happened? It's solved?
He was getting on her nerves.
One thing at a time, she said. We have to check.
Check? What do we have to check? Check how?
First of all, we have to find out where that part came from, she said. Go back to the office. Tell Norma to make sure the maintenance records are coming from LAX. And have her telex the Pfizer in Hong Kong to ask for the carrier's records. Tell him the FAA requested them and we want to look at them first.
Okay, Richmond said.
He headed off toward the open door of Hangar 5 out into the sunlight. He walked with a sort of swagger as if he were a person of importance in possession of valuable information. But Casey wasn't sure that they knew anything at all. At least, not yet.
Outside Hangar 5, 10 a.m. She came out of the hangar, blinking in the morning sun. She saw Don Brohl getting out of his car over by Building 121. She headed toward him.
Hello, Casey, he said as he slammed the door. I was wondering when you'd get back to me.
I talked to Marder, she said. He swears the wing isn't being offset to China.
Brule nodded.
He called me last night, said the same thing. He didn't sound happy.
Marder insists it's just a rumor.
He's lying, Brule said. He's doing it.
No way, Casey said. It doesn't make sense.
Look, Brule said. It doesn't matter to me personally. They close this plant in 10 years, I'll be retired. But that'll be about the time your kid starts college. You'll be looking at those big tuition payments and you won't have a job. You thought about that?
Don, she said, you said it yourself. It doesn't make sense to offset the wing. It'd be pretty reckless to...
Martyr's reckless.
He squinted at her in the sunlight.
You know that. You know what he's capable of.
Don.
Look, Brule said. I know what I'm talking about. Those tools aren't being shipped to Atlanta, Casey. They're going to San Pedro, to the port. And down in San Pedro, they're building special marine containers for shipment.
So that was how the union was putting it together, she thought.
Those are oversized tools, Don, she said. We can't ship them by road or rail. Big tools always go by boat. They're building containers so they can send them through the Panama Canal. That's the only way to get them to Atlanta.
Brule was shaking his head. I've seen the bills of lading. They don't say Atlanta, they say Seoul, Korea.
Korea? She said, frowning.
That's right.
Don, that really doesn't make sense.
Yes, it does.
Because it's a cover, Brule said. They'll send them to Korea, then transship from Korea to Shanghai.
You have copies of the bills? She said.
Not with me.
I'd like to see them, she said.
Brule sighed. I can do that, Casey. I can get them for you. But you're putting me in a very difficult situation here. The guys aren't going to let this sale happen. Marta tells me to calm them down, but what can I do? I run the local, not the plant.
What do you mean?
It's out of my hands, he said.
Don,
I always liked you, Casey, he said. But you hang around here. I can't help you.
And he walked away. Outside Hangar 5, 10:04 a.m. The morning sun was shining. The plant around her was cheerfully busy, mechanics riding their bicycles from one building to another. There was no sense of threat or danger. But Casey knew what Brule had meant. She was now in no man's land. Anxious, she pulled out her cell phone to call Marta when she saw the heavyset figure of Jack Rogers coming toward her. Jack covered aerospace for the Telegraph Star, an Orange County paper. In his late 50s, he was a good, solid reporter, a reminder of an earlier generation of print journalists who knew as much about their beat as the people they interviewed. He gave her a casual wave.
Hi, Jack, she said. What's up? I came over, he said, about that wing tool accident this morning in 64, the one the crane dropped.
Tough break, she said.
They had another accident with the AJs this morning. Tool was loaded onto the flatbed truck, but the driver took a turn too fast over by Building 94. Tool slid off onto the ground. Big mess.
Uh-huh, Casey said.
This is obviously a job action, Rogers said. My sources tell me the union's opposed to the China sale.
I've heard that, she said, nodding.
Because the wing's gonna be offset to Shanghai as part of the sales agreement?
Come on, Jack, she said. That's ridiculous.
You know that for a fact?
She took a step back from him. Jack, she said, you know I can't discuss the sale. No one can until the ink's dry.
Okay,
Rogers said. He took out his notepad.
It does seem like a pretty crazy rumor. No company's ever offset the wing. It'd be suicide.
Exactly, she said. In the end, she kept coming back to the same question. Why would Edgerton offset the wing? Why would any company offset the wing? It just made no sense.
Rogers glanced up from his pad. I wonder why the union thinks the wing's being sent offshore.
She shrugged. You'll have to ask them.
He had sources in the union, certainly Brule, probably others as well. I hear they've got documents that prove it.
Casey said. They show them to you?
Roger shook his head. No.
I can't imagine why not if they have them.
Roger smiled. He made another note. Shame about the rotor burst in Miami.
All I know is what I saw on television.
You think it will affect the public perception of the N-22?
He had his pen out, ready to take down what she said.
I don't see why. The problem was power plant, not airframe. My guess is they're going to find it was a bad compressor disc that burst. I wouldn't doubt it, he said. I was talking to Don Peterson over at the FAA. He told me that incident at SFO was a 6-stage compressor disc that blew. The disc had brittle nitrogen pockets.
Alpha inclusions, she said.
That's right, Jack said. And there was also dwell time fatigue.
Casey nodded. Engine parts operated at a temperature of 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit, well above the melt temperature of most alloys, which turned to soup at 2,200 degrees. So they were manufactured of titanium alloys, using the most advanced procedures. Fabricating some of the parts was an art. The fan blades were essentially grown as a single crystal of metal, making them phenomenally strong. But even in skilled hands, the manufacturing process was inherently delicate. Dwell time fatigue was a condition in which the titanium used to make rotor discs clumped into microstructure colonies, rendering them vulnerable to fatigue cracks.
And how about the Trans-Pacific flight? Rogers said. Was that an engine problem, too?
Trans-Pacific happened yesterday, Jack. We just started our investigation.
You're QA on the IRT, right?
Right, yes.
Are you pleased with how the investigation is going?
Jack, I can't comment on the Trans-Pacific investigation. It's much too early.
Not too early for speculation to start, Rogers said. You know how these things go, Casey. Lots of idle talk. Misinformation that can be difficult to clear up later. I'd just like to see the record straight. Have you ruled out engines?
Jack, she said, I can't comment.
Then you haven't ruled out engines.
No comment, Jack. He made a note on his pad. Without looking up, he said,
And I suppose you're looking at slats, too.
We're looking at everything, Jack, she said.
Given the 22 has a history of slats problems.
Ancient history, she said. We fixed the problem years ago. You wrote a story about it, if I recall.
But now you've had 2 incidents in 2 days. Are you worried that the flying public will start to think the N-22 is a troubled aircraft?
She could see the direction his story was going to take. She didn't want to comment, but he was telling her what he would write if she didn't. It was a standard, if minor, form of press blackmail.
Jack, she said, we've got 300 N-22s in service around the world. The model has an outstanding safety record.
In fact, in 5 years of service, there had been no fatalities involving the aircraft until yesterday. That was a reason for pride, but she decided not to mention it because she could see his lead. The first fatalities to occur on a Norton N-22 aircraft happened yesterday. Instead, she said, The public is best served by getting accurate information. And at the moment, we have no information to offer. To speculate would be irresponsible.
That did it. He took his pen away. Okay, you want to go off?
Sure. She knew she could trust him. Off the record? 545 underwent very severe pitch oscillations. We think the plane porpoised. We don't know why. The FDR's anomalous. It'll take days to reconstruct the data. We're working as fast as we can.
Will it affect the China sale?
I hope not.
Pilot was Chinese, wasn't he? Chang?
He was from Hong Kong. I don't know his nationality.
Does that make it awkward if it's pilot error?
You know how these investigations are, Jack. Whatever the cause turns out to be, it's going to be awkward for somebody.
We can't worry about that. We just have to let the chips fall where they fall. Of course, he said. By the way, is that China sale firm? I keep hearing it's not.
She shrugged. I honestly don't know.
Has Marta talked to you about it?
Not to me personally, she said.
Her reply was carefully worded. She hoped he wouldn't follow up on it.
He didn't.
Okay, Casey, he said. I'll leave this alone, but what have you got? I need to file today.
How come you're not doing cheapskate airlines? She said, using the derogatory in-house term for one of the low-cost carriers.
Nobody's done that story yet. Are you kidding? Rogers said. Everybody and his brother's covering that one.
Yeah, but nobody's doing the real story, she said. Super cheap carriers are a stock scam.
A stock scam?
Sure, Casey said. You buy some aircraft so old and poorly maintained no reputable carrier will use them for spares. Then you subcontract maintenance to limit your liability. Then you offer cheap fares and use the cash to buy new routes. It's a pyramid scheme, but on paper it looks great. Volume's up, revenue's up, and Wall Street loves you. You're saving so much on maintenance that your earnings skyrocket. Your stock price doubles and doubles again. By the time the bodies start piling up, as you know they will, you've made your fortune off the stock and afford the best counsel. That's the genius of deregulation, Jack. When the bill comes, nobody pays.
Except the passengers.
Exactly, Casey said. Flight safety's always been an honor system. The FAA's set up to monitor the carriers, not to police them. So if deregulation's going to change the rules, we ought to warn the public. Or triple FAA funding. One or the other. Rogers nodded.
Barry Jordan over at the LA Times told me he's doing the safety angle. But that takes a lot of resources. Lead time. Lawyers going over your copy. My paper can't afford it. I need something I can use tonight.
Off the record, Casey said. I've got a good lead, but you can't source it.
Sure, Rogers said.
The engine that blew was one of six that Sunstar bought from AeroCivicus, Casey said. Kenny Byrne was our consultant. He boroscoped the engines and found a lot of damage.
What kind of damage?
Blade notch breakouts and vane cracks,
Rogers said. They had fatigue cracks in the fan blades?
That's right, Casey said. Kenny told them to reject the engines, but Sunstar rebuilt them and put them on the planes. When that engine blew, Kenny was furious. So you might get a name at Sunstar from Kenny, but we can't be the source, Jack. We have to do business with these people.
I understand, Rogers said. Thanks, but my editor's going to want to know about the accidents on the floor today, so tell me, are you convinced the China offset stories are groundless?
Are we back on? She said.
Yes.
I'm not the person to ask, she said. You'll have to talk to Edgerton.
I called, but his office says he's out of town. Where is he? Beijing?
I can't comment.
And what about Martyr? Rogers said.
What about him?
Rogers shrugged. Everybody knows Martyr and Edgerton are at each other's throats. Martyr expected to be named president, but the board passed him over. But they gave Edgerton a 1-year contract, so he's only got 12 months to produce. And I hear Martyr's undercutting Edgerton every way he can.
I wouldn't know about that, she said.
Casey had, of course, heard such rumors. It was no secret that Martyr was bitterly disappointed about Edgerton's appointment. What Martyr could do about it was another story. Martyr's wife controlled 11% of company stock. With Martyr's connections, he could probably pull together 5% more. But 16% wasn't enough to call the shots, particularly since Edgerton had the strong support of the board. So most people in the plant thought that Martyr had no choice except to go along with Edgerton's agenda, at least for the moment. Martyr might be unhappy, but he had no option. The company had a cash flow problem. They were already building planes without buyers, yet they needed billions of dollars if they hoped to develop the next generation of planes and stay in business in the future. So the situation was clear. The company needed the sale. And everybody knew it, including Martyr. Rogers said, You haven't heard Martyr's undercutting Edgerton?
No comment, Casey said. But off the record, it makes no sense. Everybody in the company wants this sale, Jack, including Martyr. Right now, Martyr's pushing us hard to solve 545, so the sale goes through.
Do you think the image of the company will be hurt by the rivalry between its two top officers?
I couldn't say.
Okay, he said, finally closing his notepad. Call me if you get a break on 545, okay?
Sure, Jack.
Thanks, Casey.
Walking away from him, she realized she was exhausted by the effort of the interview. Talking to a reporter these days was like a deadly chess match. You had to think several steps ahead. You had to imagine all the possible ways a reporter might distort your statement. The atmosphere was relentlessly adversarial. It hadn't always been that way. There was a time when reporters wanted information, their questions directed to an underlying event. They wanted an accurate picture of a situation, and to do that, they had to make the effort to see things your way, to understand how you were thinking about it. They might not agree with you in the end, but it was a matter of pride that they could accurately state your view before rejecting it. The interviewing process was not very personal because the focus was on the event they were trying to understand. But now reporters came to the story with a lead fixed in their minds. They saw their job as proving what they already knew. They didn't want information so much as evidence of villainy. In this mode, they were openly skeptical of your point of view since they assumed you were just being evasive. They proceeded from a presumption of universal guilt. In an atmosphere of muted hostility and suspicion. This new mode was intensely personal. They wanted to trip you up, to catch you in a small error, or in a foolish statement, or just a phrase that could be taken out of context and made to look silly or insensitive. Because the focus was so personal, the reporters asked continuously for personal speculations.
Do you think an event will be damaging? Do you think the company will suffer?
Such speculation had been irrelevant to the earlier generation of reporters who focused on the underlying events. Modern journalism was intensely subjective, interpretive, and speculation was its lifeblood. But she found it exhausting. And Jack Rogers, she thought, was one of the better ones. The print reporters were all better. It was the television reporters you really had to watch out for. They were the really dangerous ones. Outside Hangar 5, 10:15 a.m. Crossing the plant, she fished her cell phone out of her purse and called Martyr. His assistant, Eileen, said he was in a meeting. I just left Jack Rogers, Casey said. I think he's planning a story that says we're shipping the wing to China, and there's trouble in the executive suite.
Uh-oh, Eileen said.
That's not good.
Edgerton better talk to him and put it to rest.
Edgerton isn't doing any press, Eileen said. John will be back at 6 o'clock. You want to talk to him then?
I better, yes.
I'll put you down, Eileen said. Proof test, 10:19 a.m. It looked like an aviation junkyard. Old fuselages, tails, and wing sections littered the landscape, raised up on rusty scaffolding. But the air was filled with the steady hum of compressors, and heavy tubing ran to the airplane parts like intravenous lines to a patient. This was proof test, also known as twist and shout, the domain of the infamous Amos Peters. Casey saw him off to the right, a hunched figure in shirt sleeves and baggy pants bent over a readout stand beneath an aft fuselage section of the Norton widebody. Amos, she called, waving as she walked over to him. He turned, glanced at her.
Go away.
Amos was a legend at Norton. Reclusive and obstinate, he was nearly 70, long past mandatory retirement age, yet he continued to work because he was vital to the company. His specialty was the arcane field of damage tolerance, or fatigue testing, and fatigue testing was of vastly greater importance than it had been 10 years before. Since deregulation, the carriers were flying aircraft longer than anybody ever expected. 3,000 aircraft in the domestic fleet were now more than 20 years old. That number would double in 5 years. Nobody really knew what would happen to all those aircraft as they continued to age. Except Amos. It was Amos who had been brought in by the NTSB as a consultant on the famous Aloha 737 accident back in 1988. Aloha was an inter-island carrier in Hawaii. One of their planes was cruising at 24,000 feet when suddenly 18 feet of the airplane's outer skin peeled off the fuselage, from the cabin door to the wing. The cabin decompressed, and a stewardess was sucked out and killed. Despite the explosive pressure loss, the plane managed to land safely at Maui, where it was scrapped on the spot. The rest of Aloha's fleet was examined for corrosion and fatigue damage. Two more high-time 737s were scrapped, and a third underwent months of repairs. All three had extensive skin cracks and other corrosion damage. When the FAA issued an airworthiness directive mandating inspections of the rest of the 737 fleet, 49 more planes, operated by 18 different carriers, were found to have extensive cracking. Industry observers were perplexed by the accident because Boeing, Aloha, and the FAA were supposedly all watching the carrier's 737 fleet. Corrosion cracking was a known problem on some early production 737s. Boeing had already warned Aloha that the salty, humid Hawaiian climate was a severe corrosion environment. Afterward, the investigation found multiple causes for the accident. It turned out that Aloha, making short hops between islands, was accumulating flight cycles of takeoff and landing at a faster rate than maintenance was scheduled to handle. The stress, combined with corrosion from ocean air, produced a series of small cracks in the aircraft's skin. These were unnoticed by Aloha because they were short of trained personnel. The FAA didn't catch them because they were overworked and understaffed. The FAA's principal maintenance inspector in Honolulu supervised 9 carriers and 7 repair stations around the Pacific, from China to Singapore to the Philippines. Eventually, a flight occurred in which the cracks extended and the structure failed. Following the incident, Aloha, Boeing, and the FAA formed a circular firing squad. The undetected structural damage in Aloha's fleet was variously attributed to poor management, poor maintenance, poor FAA inspection, poor engineering. Accusations ricocheted back and forth for years afterward. But the Aloha flight had also focused industry attention on the problem of aging aircraft, and it had made Amos famous within Norton. He'd convinced management to begin buying more old aircraft, turning wings and fuselages into proof test articles. Day after day, his test fixtures applied repetitive pressures to aging aircraft, stressing them to simulate takeoffs and landings, wind shear and turbulence, so Amos could study how and where they were cracked. "Amos," she said, coming up to him, "it's me, Casey Singleton." He blinked myopically.
"Oh, Casey, didn't recognize you."
He squinted at her.
"Doctor gave me a new prescription."
"Oh,
huh. How are you?"
He gestured for her to walk with him, and he headed toward a small building a few yards away. No one at Norton could understand how Casey was able to get along with Amos, but they were neighbors. He lived alone with his pug dog, and she had taken to cooking him a meal every month or so. In return, Amos regaled her with stories of aircraft accidents he'd worked on, going back to the first BOAC comet crashes in the 1950s. Amos had an encyclopedic knowledge of airplanes. She had learned a tremendous amount from him, and he had become a sort of advisor to her.
"Didn't I see you the other morning?" he said.
"Yes, with my daughter."
"Thought so. Want coffee?"
He opened the door to a shed, and she smelled the sharp odor of burned grounds. His coffee was always terrible.
"Sounds great, Amos," she said. He poured her a cup. "Hope black is okay. Ran out of that creamer stuff."
"Black is fine, Amos." He hadn't had creamer for a year. Amos poured a cup for himself in a stained mug and waved her to a battered chair facing his desk. The desk was piled high with thick reports. FAA NASA International Symposium on Advanced Structural Integrity, Airframe Durability and Damage Tolerance, Thermographic Inspection Techniques, Corrosion Control, and Structures Technology. He put his feet up on the desk, cleared a path through the journals so he could see her.
"I tell you, Casey, it's tedious working with these old hulks. Along for the day when we have another T2 article in here."
"T2?" she said.
"Of course you wouldn't know," Amos said. "You've been here 5 years, and we haven't made a new model aircraft in all that time. But when there's a new aircraft, the first one off the line is called T1, Test Article 1. It goes to static test. We put it on the test bed and shake it to pieces, find out where..."